Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Maybe boy, maybe girl hiding out there in the crowd. Hopefully that you have fun things to do other than this on your Saturday morning. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. I'm Jake McClure. And on the phone, we're going to see if we can do this, is our co-host, Jeff McClure.
You mean old Baldy, don't you?
I mean Elder Baldy himself, yes. Younger Baldy is here in the studio. Elder Baldy is taking care of health by not being in public. It'd be really nice if we could both do this from home, but then somebody else would have to be in here doing this.
Well, I appreciate your bravery in getting out into the coronavirus-infected public.
Well, for the first time at the studio, there was a sign that said you should wear masks. Though I'm not wearing a mask when speaking to the microphone. I did spray the microphone down with disinfectant, I think this might be helpful for people to hear. The first thing I do when I get to the studio, it's usually empty, is I get out the spray and the hand sanitizer, and I wipe down all the surfaces, and I'm evidently not the only one doing it. The control board has these pieces of tape on them with permanent ink, the permanent Sharpie marker saying what different controls do. Permanent probably doesn't hold up very well to repeated alcohol sterilization by multiple people every day. So it's starting to fade. Some of it's still really easy to read, and other stuff I'm going on memory.
There's a good metaphor there somewhere.
Yeah.
About what's going on in the economy. Things we thought were permanent by the time we finish this event. This coronavirus event. We need to have a name for this thing.
I'm still calling it dumpster fire.
Yeah, well, no one is picking up on the name. You're not exactly got a
call it
groundswell of support.
Back in plague time.
We need to get a name. The 2020 COVID.
Back in COVID when the 20 was there, bad news. I'm just trying to figure out how
the 2020 pandemic.
Well, yeah, that doesn't really flow trippingly from the tongue. We just call it COVID most of the time, before COVID. But it really doesn't encapsulate all of the fun and not-so-fun pieces of 2020.
Yeah, well, I mean, we had a good name for the last one, the Black Death.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that wasn't quite the last one, but yeah.
It was a last one, but it does kind of flow off the tongue. This is not quite as romantic. It's more like the 1918 flu.
Yeah, we've got a lot of other stuff going on, too. I mean, it's a second level of civil rights movement. We've got the economy doing stuff that it didn't do in 1918, or any other time for that matter.
We've mentioned this before, but it's worth mentioning. And there's a book called Generations, The History of America's Future, 1584 to 2069. That actually cites, and written in the late 1980s, published in 1992, and actually refers to the crisis, the socioeconomic crisis of 2020.
Right. Because we're due for one. We just got a little bit extra. A little bit more than we expected.
Boy, now we got an email comment question already. Did you see this? And
Let's give out the emails while we're at it.
We'll do it.
Okay.
If you wish to contact us, we've only got one telephone line, and I'm tying it up. This is occupied telephone line. But you can email us at either jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Now, if you just like to type a lot, you can actually type out Jeff or Jake at thepersonalwealthcoach.com, but TPWC is easier. We ought to do our disclosures and disclaimers.
Let's do that, and then we can hit the question.
Okay. You want to start them, or you want me to start them?
Sure, I'll start. The Personal Wealth Coach, is not only the radio program that you all love so much. I may be interpreting your emotion a little strongly for the dreary science, but you love us. It's also an investment advisory firm that's registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Now, that does not imply that they like us in any way. I'm implying that you guys like us. The Securities and Exchange Commission's job is not to like anybody. Their job is to enforce the law and make sure that regulations are being followed. So they're not endorsing us in any way. They don't do that. You want to get the next disclosure? That this isn't investment advice, or you want to do the? Do you want me to handle that?
I can do that.
Okay.
What we're giving on this radio program is educational information and not investment advice, despite the fact that the Personal Wealth Coach is an investment advisory firm. Investment advice is given to individuals based on their specific and peculiar, sometimes more peculiar than others, needs, desires, risk tolerances, and lots of stuff. But investment information or planning information, which is what we're giving here for education, is general and it applies to just about everybody.
Good.
Do you want to go on the fact that we don't pay for the radio? I'll tell you.
We don't pay for the
radio program. They don't pay us for the radio program. We do advertise on KTEM for the radio program. And that's one of the disclosures we're required to give, so we're giving it.
Awesome. So we're providing an educational service because we want to. That's the bottom line.
Well, we get some advantages from it.
Yeah,
a lot of our clients listen, and this is our opportunity to communicate with our clients. So it works out pretty well.
Yeah. All right. So you want to hit the market, and I think we hit all the disclosures. You can talk about what the market did, and then we can talk about the question, because I don't have a copy of the question. They sent it to you and not me.
Well, it's okay. I can see it. Well, the stock market dropped. The S&P 500 stock index at least drops 2.86.
Is this an IP address
for the week?
You're putting in an address in the computer.
Well, I'm trying to put more points in. 2.86% for the week and closed down to 3,009.05, which is at the bottom of its trading range. The bottom of the trading range that it's been in for the past several weeks is between 3,000 and 3,200, which is a big variance historically, but still it's not out the bounds yet. It's not in back into another bear market. It's in the trading range. It's down 6.86% year-to-date, down 11.14% from its top in February, but it's still up about 34.5% from where it was in March. And it's up 2.29% from last year at this time, which is not a lot.
It's not a lot, but compared, I mean, when we're talking about the socioeconomic freeze of 2020, the economy, bam, stops. And our
economy is down a lot more than the market.
Yeah, the market is up from 12 months ago, while the economy is definitely not. And that's not that unusual to have the two be apart. That's something we get a lot of questions on. So go ahead. Yes, I'm sorry.
Well, I think the reason for the fall is just as important as the fact that it fell 2.86% for the week, and that is the main reason that's at least cited in the news media is Texas. Do I need to say anything else about that?
Just that it's Texas?
Yeah, Texas.
Texas and Florida and Arizona and Oklahoma, and there's a few.
Well, actually, Florida was kind of written off because they tested a lot more people. And so the fact that they had a record number of new cases in Florida could be kind of explained away that they did more testing. Although, interestingly enough, the percentage of people testing positive hasn't changed. But there's a gold standard for the COVID crisis, and it is how many people are in the hospital. Because you can say testing, if you do more testing, you wind up with more cases, and that's true. If you do a lot of random testing, you're finding out that there's more people infected than we thought. But when you look at the number of people who are admitted to hospitals and who are in the hospital specifically for COVID-19, that's a pretty solid number. And Texas broke records. Matter of fact, in Houston, for example, in the last 2 weeks, the hospitalization rate has risen by 47%, which is the kind of thing we saw happen in New York City. When the COVID was out of control, And there's some indication that COVID may be out of control in Texas at this point. I think you were saying that Austin was having similar reports.
Yeah, well, per 100,000 people, their infection rate's higher than Houston at the moment. And they're more of the younger folks in Travis County have been infected. There's a younger population there. And they tend to be hospitalized less and tend to have a lower mortality rate. But it certainly doesn't make it a good thing. What's happening.
The other thing, that, and it'll make big headlines when it happens, is making minor deep dig in the story paragraphs right now, is the health officials in Harris County down there where Houston is are saying that they're likely to run out of ICU beds in about a week, a little over a week.
Yeah, at this rate of growth, yeah.
If the growth is apparently accelerating. The growth in Texas has doubled.
It's doubled twice. It's doubled twice. It went from April to May was a double, and then, well, late May from early May was a double, and then now we're at double that again.
And that is, by the way, the kind of acceleration in infection growth and in hospitalization growth that we saw in New York City, when New York City was hesitant to shut down. It was early in this crisis, and you may not remember it, but we remember it very well because we keep records on these things. But New York City was afraid to shut down for fear of wrecking their economy, and they saw this kind of growth. And it was not until they ran out of ICU beds in New York City that they started getting really serious about this. And it looks very much like Houston is headed in that direction. There have been the economy is not shut down in Houston. Stores are still open. Everything is continuing to run pretty much as it was.
Pretty much as it was during the open up process.
Right.
Yeah. And something to note is that when the governor said that he on Friday yesterday said that he'd be going back to 50% at the restaurants and closing down alcohol at bars. He set the date for that on Monday.
Wait a minute. They didn't close down the alcohol in bars. You just have to do your drinking before noon.
Unless it's Sunday and then you can't drink at all.
Yeah. So tomorrow you can run out. Well, not tomorrow. Today, you've got an hour and 40 minutes to get your drinking done in the bars.
Or you could just go to the liquor store and do it by yourself and at home.
Or you can do takeout.
We're not making a recommendation here. We're being a little bit tongue-in-cheek. That, yes, bars are one of the biggest vector points for the spread of this, and that people are in a loud environment with their inhibitions lowered. So they're right in each other's faces and yelling in a good way and sometimes in a bad way. All of that stuff's not good. And it doesn't help that there are large groups of people that gather to protest and other large groups of people that gather to rally, and whether or not you call a rally a protest or a protest a rally depends on where you're standing, I think, at this point. So,
well, actually, the areas where they had the big protests outside,
mm-hmm,
so far have seen no spikes.
Well, there have been a few in the Northeast. There were a few, and there were some protests that were canceled because some of the protests organizers tested positive. So that's happening.
That makes sense. Yeah.
But big rallies and big protests or big protests and big rallies, whomever you're for or against at that point, they're vector points. And the more masks you wear, the better. It's better to be outside than inside. This is not political in any stretch, except that to some extent there are groups of people in support of the president that are going against the advice of the White House, which is fascinating because the official advice from the White House is still wear masks, but the action from the White House is not. So groups of people that follow the president are looking at this and saying, all right, do what he does, not what he says. And then they're making it into a political slogan. And this is a normal way that political slogans happen. This is one that is worse for the people doing it than for the people not doing it, though. So not wearing masks together may get your point across, but you may also get the virus across, and that's a problem. And I think what we're going to need to see, unfortunately, and we've talked about this for months, people don't tend to start taking it that seriously until they know somebody that's gotten it or know somebody that's died. And I hate that we cannot just look around and learn from the rest of humanity around us and other countries and our own to say, people die from this. Let's not get it. But that's where we need to be. Yeah.
The other thing in the market, there's got several things in the market that are fascinating. The 10-year Treasury note yield is a real good forecaster of what the bond market thinks is coming as far as economic vitality is concerned. And it dropped to 0.647% after a few weeks ago was closing up near 1%. It's down to basically it's had about a 40-some percent drop in the last few weeks. It's down 7% this week. But the positive thing in the Treasury yield is that the curve remains positive.
Yeah.
And even with the bad news that came out this week, the yield curve is still remaining positive. A year ago, it was negative forecasting recession. We definitely have a recession going on. And so the yield curve, the Treasury yield curve, continues to forecast better times to come next year. And it's a pretty accurate forecasting device.
Yeah. And even with this spike, and I'm going to throw this in here, part of the reason why that forecast is doing well, even with the spike in Texas and in Oklahoma and Arizona and Florida, if we go back partially, if we take steps back, our economy's still not in total lockdown like it was, or close to total lockdown like it was at the depths in April through May. So it's still going to look better than the month before. However, we're coming up on the end of the quarter, which means in 2 or 3 weeks, we're going to start getting information on how things were in the big economy for this second quarter. We're going to start to see earnings reports coming out from corporations on how they did in the second quarter. And I'm going to tell you something right now, it shouldn't surprise you, it's going to be bad. We're already on kind of an uptick from there, but when you look back at that quarter and you see the numbers, they're going to be bad, bad numbers. We've been talking about this for a long time, but that's a very important piece of information to hold into when the big numbers come out and they're bad. They're talking about that thing that we knew was bad when it was happening, but it's still behind us. We're still going through bad stuff, and on the viral end of things, we're not through the worst of it. On the economic side of things, we might be.
Forecasters at Moody's, which have been pretty much the lead accurately forecasting organization, Moody's, it's called economy.com now, but it's Moody's Economics. They did a really good job of forecasting what was coming in 2008 and 2009. And so they have a lot of credibility. They're saying that their high frequency tracker is suggesting that the number that will come out for the second quarter, which we're just about to end, will be a negative 37% for GDP growth. Now that's an annualized number, and it's important to remember you got to divide it by four. Round figures, then, it is going to be about a 9 or 10% drop in economic activity in profits and the GDP of the United States for the second quarter. And I think more and more as I look at this thing, that sounds like an accurate number.
And I agree with that.
And I think we'll wind up at the end of the year with about a 10% drop for the year. But that's way out in the future, and that depends on a lot of factors.
Yeah, and it could be worse or better than that, depending on those factors. If we get some sort of unforeseeable event where we get the vaccine out a lot faster than we expect to, then that number could be a lot nicer looking than a drop.
I just can't imagine the vaccine when we don't have an approved vaccine yet.
Right, and that would be the thing. We can't see this. I don't see any path to it beyond a vague one. If India says we're just going to start distributing the vaccine, because they're in for something that makes what we're in for look like. Ours looks like a walk in the park compared to what's going to be happening in India in the near future. And that's not me being pessimistic or saying, just looking at the numbers and their ability to slow it down. They can't lock down the way we can. They don't.
Well, they tried.
Yeah, the vast majority of their living space doesn't allow for lockdown. They have shared living space with many dozens of other people, no matter where they live. Unless they're extremely wealthy. And the vast majority of India, big surprise, is not very wealthy. So
you're probably aware of this, but when they shut down the businesses in the cities, it caused the workers, who are mostly from rural areas, to suddenly lose their jobs.
Yeah, and what do they do?
So there's a mass migration from the cities where the coronavirus was spreading quickly back out into the rural areas, and it seems that they probably took the coronavirus with them because now they're getting a second wave in the rural areas.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they didn't want to do.
Major first wave for the rural areas that hadn't been touched yet. Yeah.
And we're getting some degree of that in the United States. I don't think it's not the mass migration. It's just that what we're getting is, and this is very typical with pandemics, it hits in the cities first. Matter of fact, the 1918 flu did. It hits in the cities first and then gradually works its way out into the rural areas, and eventually it gets everybody.
Right. And the second wave tends to happen when the rural area comes back to the big city. That's when the second wave really hits, historically. We do have a question.
Sure.
Do you have the same question I have about ESG and the Labor Department?
I do.
Do you want to explain what that is first, or do you want to answer the question first?
Well, the ESG investing, which has become very popular in the last couple of years, there are now like 3,100 institutional investors and businesses provide. There's ESG factor funds, conventional mutual funds, rose from 564, from 81 to 564 since 2018.
Yeah.
ESG funds are environmental, social factors, and corporate governance. Basically, it's if you really want to be green and you want to ensure that the companies you're investing in are morally pure.
It's sustainable, and not necessarily morally. It doesn't get into more. It just means sustainable, and they're using green power where they can. And their corporate governance is taking into account ethnicity and sexual orientation, that sort of thing.
Well, in one sense, it's a morally pure. In other words, doing things that are not that are not just legal, but they're moral and helping the economy and not helping the economy so much, but helping the environment and doing all kinds of good things. Those are ESG funds. Now, the point is that the Labor Department said the purpose under ERISA, the Employee Retirement Security Act of 1974.
Yeah, you skipped income in there, though.
Employee
Retirement Income Security Act, yeah.
Right. Is that they should be managed in such a way as to provide the best investment solutions. In other words, in the sense that having the maximum return given the variance or market risk that they're taking. In other words, there's a pretty clear set of standards, and it has only to do with investment outcomes. And the warning from the Labor Department is you can't substitute ESG funds in there that have lower performance just because people would like to invest in a more pure fashion. You have to stick with the best performing, the funds that are most likely to perform well to generate retirement income, not moral purity.
Now, the question from the listener in the email was, do we think this is going to stay? Do we think it's going to pass? Because this is a proposed rule, and the Labor Department is good at proposing rules, and rules that get taken up are another story. It depends on a lot of things.
It would take Congress amending ERISA, which it's done many times,
yeah,
to allow for ESG funds with lower performance in order to change this.
Right.
And bottom line to it is the law is very clear on this, so it's not it's a proposed rule, but it's going to go through because it's completely consistent with the law.
Here is the
a different issue.
Yeah, here is the conundrum. During the last 5 years before dumpster fire, ESG funds did at least as well as the rest of the market, in some cases better. But they don't have a whole lot of records on that time period. And during the downturn, they performed much worse than the rest of the market. Traditionally, when we look at companies that are run based on some type of moral guideline, there's some Christian company mutual funds out there that won't invest in tobacco or alcohol or pornography.
Or firearms.
And there's different versions of some of them just do no alcohol, others do some combination of that. There's also, the Sharia law version of the Christian law version, they're very similar and usually run by the same companies that are looking and using the same mix, because Sharia law looks a lot like some very conservative Christian rules. Those traditionally have way underperformed the market, gone down faster and recovered slower. And we've talked about that in the past when clients have called up and said, what do you think about these ESGs? And we say, well, it looks like the companies are making decisions that they believe will better the entirety of the world, but we want to make sure that they can do that profitably. If they're not doing it profitably, it doesn't help for us to give them money. That's, if you want to give money to charity that will help the entire world, let's do it directly. Let's not go through a for-profit institute to do it. And that's basically what the Labor Department is saying, too. Go ahead.
One of the problems with ESG funds is there's no clear definition of what it means. In other words, it's up to the individual.
Well, Morningstar.
To say this is ESG. No, you could say it's an ESG fund, but when we try to define, okay, environmental, social, and governance factors, here's a solid definition of what that means.
Well, ESG is a trademark term for Morningstar, and I think they're going to lose the trademark because so many other people are using it, but they're the ones that say this is an ESG right now, which is a little bit weird. So if you're in an ESG that's not a Morningstar ESG, then it's not technically an ESG? How do you define that? Because some people are. Sorry, back to you.
Well, the point is that it's not clearly defined. There's no clear, solid definition. In other words, one ESG fund might invest in something that another ESG fund would find repugnant and not invest in it. So
right.
It's really difficult to nail down. I've read several articles in the Wall Street Journal over the past several months that compared various ESG funds, and some of them aren't very ESG at all.
Yeah, well,
but they claim to be an ESG fund, and that's how they're marketing themselves.
Yeah,
but there's no definition, they can get away with marketing themselves that way.
At the Morningstar conference, which I attended virtually, they were talking about ESG and how there's some asset classes that run into a lot of problems. But to talk about one that is a very generalized one, is Walmart an ESG company? And some would say yes, and some would say no. ESG, economic, is not part of E. It's ecological.
Right.
And Walmart's going to solar power in a lot of its big facilities. A lot of the big stores are going to solar power. Does that now meet the requirement for the E? Now you flip it to another asset class, emerging markets. These are companies that are in countries that are coming out of sort of the Stone Age, and they're rising up, and their population is becoming more developed. There are ESGs in Saudi Arabia that are state owned. Saudi Aramco is owned in some ESGs because for the area it's ESG, but this is an oil company that the government says that women shouldn't drive. So is that an ESG? Well, technically, according to the designation, ESG has been given to a bunch of Saudi companies. So I think it's smart, and we don't say this a lot about governmental new regulations, but I think it's smart for the Labor Department to step in and say, hey, this area isn't, you can't just put the priority on this. The law says you have to put the priority on sustaining the customer or the client's income from the investment in retirement.
Which I think a lot of people forget that they're 401ks or 403bs or whatever.
Or pensions, not, yeah.
They're not tools for doing something else. They're designed to provide income in retirement. And if you lose sight of that and it starts to be used for something else, it waters it down. One of the things that bothers me is there's this steady drumbeat of you can take money out of your 401k without paying penalties
because
for this or for that
right.
or something else. Right
yeah.
now for COVID. If somebody in your family gets COVID, you can take money out of the 401k
yeah.
or your IRA without paying a penalty. Well, wait a minute, that's retirement funding. And any time that you take money out, let's say you're 30 years old today and you're planning to retire at 65, you've taken out, every dollar you take out is very likely to be worth multiple dollars when you retire, and you will lose that value.
Wait, before we say very likely, it depends on where it's invested, and historical numbers is what we're talking about.
Right.
So long term.
Well, even if it's in a bank, even
yeah.
if it's in a bank and it's earning interest and it has a guaranteed interest rate, that's why I said several dollars, not multiples. You know, it all depends. Historically, it would have been worth lots and lots, but that's beside the point. The purpose in investing today for retirement is to produce income in retirement that's larger than what you invested. And if you use it for something else, it doesn't ever get to do this. Kind of, well, it's, we can talk about chickens and eggs.
Which came first?
Well, I
ordered one of each from Amazon, and we'll see.
Your the money you have in your IRA or your 401k or your 403b is the chicken. The chicken keeps laying eggs, and if the eggs are allowed to develop into new chickens, you get lots more eggs down the road.
But you could eat the chicken.
If you start eating the chickens,
they're
taking money out of your IRA or out of your 401k to use for something in the current environment.
Chicken.
Then you don't have enough chickens to last when you quit work.
Yeah. And so there are times when it's appropriate to take money out of retirement vehicles that aren't for retirement, but not very many. They're very, very limited. A lot of people have done the whole, I'm going to take a loan from my 401k to pay for my kids' college. And that's a big negative that people don't understand. You've got to take money out of the 401k. You didn't have to pay taxes on it as a loan. You didn't have to pay taxes on it to put it in there if it's not a Roth, just a traditional IRA or a traditional 401k. You take that loan out. It's got an interest payment on it. And now you're paying it somewhere else. Now, when you put the money back into the 401k to pay that debt back, you've already paid taxes on the money that you're using to pay the debt back. You pay the taxes now, it goes back in there, and when you take it out, you pay the taxes again. When it's said like that, people are less likely to do it, even though if you got a loan, a student loan to pay the college costs. There's an interest rate on that, and you're going to pay it back with money you've already paid taxes on. The difference is that people don't realize that they have to pay taxes on it when they pay it back. The money that they're paying back doesn't come out of their paycheck in the same way. So they think it's a better deal than it is. It's generally better to not touch the retirement side of things, which in many cases is exempt from liabilities. If you're in a bankruptcy or if you're in a lawsuit, many, many cases, that's protected money. You've got to talk to an attorney about this, but as soon as you take it out to do something else with it, here's an example of something I've heard happening a lot with people taking penalty-free money for COVID. They use it to pay off their credit cards. They don't have a job. Somebody in their family's sick. They take the money out. They pay off their credit cards. They still have debts they can't pay. They're looking at their 401k and going, maybe I can take more out to pay like my monthly bills and so on. The problem is that credit cards, when they go bad and you can't pay them, bankruptcy is a real option, and sometimes it's a better option than to deplete your long-term retirement stuff, because that stuff a lot of times is exempt from bankruptcy. If you can't pay your credit card, they can't come and take your car or your house. They can't take your 401k. If you use your 401k to pay it back, now you're passing that problem into the future, and bankruptcy has a really good use. We're certainly not recommending everybody go out and get it, but there are circumstances that allow our economy to recover better because of bankruptcy.
You sound like Ed Laughlin.
Well, maybe a little bit.
You know, the other thing is, if let's just say that you had taken a loan in January or February against your 401k to pay for your kids' college, thinking I'll just pay that back and there'll be no penalties and it's not a problem. You don't have a lot of, you don't have the money available right on, in front of you to pay it back, and you got laid off. Now you have a real problem because you have to put that money back into that 401k. I don't remember the time limitations on it. There's a distinct, it's a matter of days, the time limitations.
Yeah.
90 days, I think it is. And I may be wrong on that. You have to put that money back in the 401k if you get laid off, or it becomes a taxable withdrawal, and you get hit with the taxes even when you, and then you don't have any money to pay the taxes with. And people have, that's been a really serious problem that people have run into. You don't know when you're going to lose your job. And when you have a loan from the 401k and you lose your job, you have to put the money back in or it becomes a taxable distribution.
Yeah.
So borrowing money from a 401k is an extremely risky procedure, to say the least.
Yeah. So I said there's very few times when that's not the case. What are those few times? Can you imagine one of those few times for me?
A forced early retirement. In other words, you're sick.
Yeah.
And you basically have got a forced early retirement. Then taking
it's
money for retirement.
It's retirement money at that point. So the whole thing about the Labor Department is that their job is to make sure that you have income in retirement, even if they don't have total control over that. They're supposed to regulate it. How well they do it is kind of up in the air. They put rules out that don't get passed through, and they put other rules out that do, and some of them help and some of them hinder. It's the government. But their job is to protect the income. So ESGs, taking loans from a 401k before retirement, taking withdrawals from your retirement accounts before retirement, all of those things, believe it or not, have a negative against your retirement. And people go, well, of course they do. Well, it needs to be very thoroughly understood that you're taking money from yourself when you do that. And you're taking money out from yourself, if it's in a pension or something along those lines, at a compounded rate, and potentially at a compounded rate in 401ks and so on, much worse than what that nice little interest rate looks like.
I'm in favor of treating your 401k like it's a pension.
Yeah, I agree.
You can't borrow money against a company pension.
And we have to play some commercials.
We do.
We will be back on the other side with
more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join the conversation, unfortunately, you can't do it through the phone because we've moved back in time in that respect, but you can email us, which is maybe a move forward from the mid-20th century at least. Email addresses are jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, as in thepersonalwealthcoach.com. And we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure, and on the phone we have
Jeff McClure.
All right. There's always a leap of faith there, as I hope you're still there when I pull your line back up.
I think I'm still, well, actually I'm not there, I'm here.
Oh, well, that's good to know.
So, we're still here. Hey, you got something you need to talk about?
Well, there's another question that just popped up.
Okay.
It may be mildly tongue-in-cheek. It's hard to tell in an email, but I think so. Now that there's a movement to make Washington, D.C. the 51st state, should we invest in U.S. flag manufacturers?
No.
That is quite humorous. Unfortunately,
made overseas.
Fortunately, unfortunately, depends on where you stand, I guess. It's very, very, very vanishingly small chance that this is going to make it through the Senate. That Washington,
this time.
Yeah, this time. The reality is that what they're proposing is a much smaller district around the Capitol infrastructure, the stuff that's actually owned by the federal government in Washington, D.C., and make that the autonomous D.C. zone, the District of Columbia that's run by the Congress and by the president. 'Cause you know, from their perspective, if you're living in D.C., you were born in D.C., you grew up in D.C., you've got an electoral college member, so your vote for the president still works. But you have zero say when it comes to taxes. If you're, and they have an elected House of Representative representer, but they
can't vote.
She can't vote. She just sits there and says, nice to know that. I can talk, but I can't vote. So from the perspective of somebody that lives in D.C., that doesn't sound very nice. That's what they're talking about. It's all about no taxation without representation. But it's being opposed by the Senate, by the Republicans in the Senate. The definition of why they're opposing...
Tom Cotton had a really good speech as to why he opposed it.
Oh, what were his points?
He says that there's a lot of fishermen in Alaska, and there's a lot of loggers in Montana, and a lot of ranchers in Montana, and these are people who work with their hands, and they don't need to have their votes diluted. And the point is,
wait,
the argument what? In favor of a state of D.C. being a state,
mm-hmm.
is its combined population is larger than I think three states.
Yeah.
And the three states all have members of the House of Representatives, and the three states all have two senators each, but the
right.
people in the District of Columbia have no senators
and only
no vote in the House.
Right, no vote in the House, one representative. They would still have one representative that would have a vote. They would also have two senators, and that's the real sticking point politically. And you would think, well, the Democrats must surely want this. Well, the Democrats are the ones that are supporting it now, but there's not a great deal of enthusiasm in the Democratic base for this because it has the potential of diluting their votes in the Senate, too. So this is certainly not a we're looking out for your best interest, D.C. population. This is a, well, you're going to change the status quo pretty hard for both parties. What it would do if it passed and went all the way through, there'd be two more Democratic senators almost guaranteed. And that is not something that the Republicans in the Senate want. You can talk about diluting a vote for somebody that lives in Montana, or you can talk about the opposite of that. Well, nobody gets a vote if they live in D.C. for tax purposes. So I think the people without the vote probably are suffering more than the people would suffer that have a vote that is mildly diluted. But if you're a sitting senator and your party's in power by just a hair, and you're looking ahead at an election and saying it might not go my way, that's going to determine part of your vote. So as much as I would like to say all our flags are going to have more stars on it, or as much as I wouldn't like to say that, I don't think it's going to happen. So I haven't invested any of my emotion into it. I don't have a pro or against in this particular one because I don't see it as realistic this time around.
Well, not this time around, but no matter what you think the next election is going to look like, there is a surge back and forth that occurs in the United States. Democrats will control the Senate for a while, and
right.
then the Republicans will control the Senate for a while, and the same is true in the House.
Yeah, and I suspect if we get what the polls are showing now, if there's this massive Democrat landslide, then D.C. will likely become a state in the next year or two. But if not, then it doesn't happen. I don't think it's got a chance of happening now, though.
No, it doesn't. It's a symbolic measure, I think. The Republicans are against it, and the Republicans control the majority in the Senate, so it's not going to... Well, the president would veto it anyway.
Yeah, and he said he would. So even if the Senate said, yes, we're doing this, the president's going to say no. So it's got no chance, unless something, you know, I'm not going to say no chance about anything anymore. There's no chance of me saying no chance. Wait a minute. Because things change and weirdnesses happen. We can sound all sophisticated and call it a black swan, or we can just go, whoa, that was unexpected. That's more what most of us are saying, but then sounding very sophisticated. Well, it was simply a black swan, and who can predict those?
There's another thing that went on, at least if you're following economic news, and that is that consumer spending, personal consumption report,
right,
is a big chunk of consumer spending, jumped 8.5%, now, which is a record. I mean, 8.2%, which is the largest since we've been measuring personal consumption. Having it jump 8.2% is just astonishing, and it really looks good. And the headlines I'm reading are pointing out that this is the biggest jump. And so there's a, I use the term euphoric to describe it. I mean, people are saying it's wonderful. The economy's recovering. Biggest jump on record. The problem is, if you add up the decline that occurred before May, that was, it leaves us still down 12%.
Right.
The other thing is, and I was looking at the numbers for the disposable income, and when you look at all the numbers that go together, the disposable income dropped significantly in May, and the savings were 23%, and we had 8.2% jump in spending. And those don't add up. If people are saving a lot more money and spending a lot more money while their income dropped almost 6%, they just don't seem to add up at all. So I had to do some digging to figure out what was going on. And, of course, April is when the stimulus checks hit, and that was counted as part of the income. So
right,
the drop in income is strictly stimulus checks going away. And what's happening is the money that people got that they were going to spend, they spent largely in May, not in April, because it took them a little while from the time they deposited the check until they spent the money. But the and if you look, we had 33% savings in April, and then and in May, then we dropped to 23%. So that's where the actually the 8.2% rise in expenditures came from. Will that continue? I don't think so. I don't like to make forecasts about the future. I don't like to make forecasts, particularly when they're about the future. But still, it looks very, very much like that 8.2% rise in personal consumption was not a matter of everybody got out and started shopping like mad again. It's a matter of a lot of people went out and had a lot more money in their bank account than they're used to having and spent some of it.
Right. I have a demographic change to update you with, if you're okay with changing the subject at
sure.
this point. This will be the first election, presidential election coming up, where the baby boomers are not the largest generation.
Well, we'll be the first one.
Well, the first one for a while, since
yeah.
my lifetime.
So I start to say the baby boomers, contrary to their beliefs being one, have not been around forever.
From my perspective, they have. The entire length of my life, you guys have been around. Generation X, which is what I'm a part of, is not the most populous generation either. It's the millennials. That's a completely different way of looking at possible shifts in political issues in the future, is that the baby boomers, and if you look who is running for president right now, you have a choice between a baby boomer or a baby boomer. And if you look back a little ways, you'll find that that's been the case for about the last five elections, maybe more than that. I need to look at the numbers on that. But going back, Clinton was the first elected president that of the baby boomer generation. So George H.W. Bush was a hero generation. Clinton ran against him and then against Dole later. Dole was also hero generation. They were from the greatest generation era. The silent generation, which is between the two, never has had anybody run for president from it. So then, since then, it's been Clinton, George W. Bush, Obama, and then Trump. And so we've got we've got four presidents, but a lot more elections than that, because multiples of those presidents had multiple terms, and they've been baby boomers running against baby boomers. We're going to have that this election too, but the baby boomers aren't going to be the largest group voting. That's the biggest shift.
If they vote,
yeah. The baby boomers may not want to vote.
No, I'm talking about if the millennials vote.
Oh, well, the millennials might not want to vote too. I think that they should all get out and vote. I agree,
but the millennials have been very, very poor at showing up at the polls.
The majority of the people that are embracing new political movements right now are millennials.
Right.
And there is a really strong impression that I'm getting that this may be the first presidential election that they really jump into. To vote for a baby boomer, yeah. And that's historically pretty accurate. When we look at this sort of thing, when I bring up demographics like this, you brought up the book Generations, and we're about out of time. We're going to need to talk about this next hour because there's a lot of meat in here. If you'd like to contact us off the air,
the phone number to call, voicemail available, 947-1111 or 800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN, and we'll be back next.